today. Before we do that, I would like to welcome the Berlin High School students who are here with court with class. Would they rise? Good. Welcome to you. Will you please be seated? We are also glad to welcome with us students from Lawrence University. Would they please rise? And welcome to you all. Please be seated. The students have been provided with the synopses of the case they're about to hear, and they will meet with Justice Geske and me at noon, and will be joined by students from Hamilton High School who were here for the first oral argument. Now that we've met you, I'd like to introduce the court to everyone here. On my far left is Justice Patrick Brooks. To his right is Justice Jeanine Geske. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. And to his right, Justice John Wilcox. And at the far right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With the introductions made, I will now call the second case and the last case for the March sitting, 97-0938-CR, State v. Bassos. Appearing for the state is Pamela McGee, Assistant Attorney General. Ms. McGee.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Pamela McGee. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State Justice Department, and I'm here this morning representing the plaintiff appellant in this action, the state of Wisconsin. This case comes to this court on certification from the Court of Appeals. As you're aware, the defendant in this case was initially charged with felony substantial battery in violation of Section 940.19(3). Although both parties requested a lesser included offense instruction for misdemeanor battery, the trial judge refused to offer such an instruction, and the jury acquitted the defendant of the charge. The state then charged the defendant with misdemeanor battery in violation of Section 940.19(1), and the defendant moved to dismiss based on a claim of double jeopardy. The trial court thereupon dismissed the complaint, and the state appealed. The state takes the position that the trial court was in error by dismissing the new charge on the grounds of double jeopardy. The federal and state constitutions protect against successive prosecutions following conviction or acquittal, but only to a certain extent. The defining characteristic of a permissible successive prosecution when it's based on an identical course of conduct is that the new charge requires proof of elements which are not the same as those in the original charge. In other words, it's not the same offense. This test derives, of course, from the United States Supreme Court case of Blockberger versus the United States, and it has served as a guide for an analysis of double jeopardy problems such as the one presently before the court since its issuance in 1932. This court has relied upon its guidance since that time, including in recent cases such as State versus Casella. That case delineated once again the three questions which must be posed in an analysis of the issue presently at bar. That is, whether the elements of the offense are incorporated into the elements of an offense already prosecuted, whether prosecution of the new charge would result in relitigating factual issues which have already been decided to the defendant's benefit, and whether each offense necessarily requires proof of an element the other does not. The last issue is the only one in issue here and must be answered in the state's favor. This is so because misdemeanor battery necessarily requires proof of two additional elements not required by the charge on which defendant was tried and acquitted. That is, that the victim did not consent to the bodily harm inflicted, and the defendant knew that the victim did not consent. It follows then, by virtue of application of the same elements test, the two charges may be brought successively, as they were in this case. In other words, the Blockberger test, as enunciated once again by this court in Kurosawa, when applied to the facts of this case, establishes that the second charge lodged against the defendant was not precluded by the constitutional prohibition against double jeopardy in the context of successive prosecutions. Of course, the legislature can extend greater protections than those required by the constitutions, and it is within this context that Section 93971 and Section 93966 of our statutes must be harmonized. Section 93971 is the statutory expression of the Blockberger test. It makes no reference to Section 93966 and clearly states on its face that successive prosecutions may take place if, following conviction or acquittal on the merits under one provision, the second statutory provision requires proof of a fact which the other does not require. As has already been discussed, by applying this test, it must be concluded that the two battery statutes in question are not the same offense, and therefore, under Section 93971, a successive prosecution is permitted. This leaves only Section 93966 for discussion. That statute, too, reflects the codification of Blockberger in subsection 1, and then goes on to artificially designate a number of offenses as lesser included offenses, even though they have separate elements. Now, these offenses would pass the Blockberger test and the 93971 test if they were analyzed according to whether a difference in elements exists, as we have shown in our brief and I have mentioned earlier in this argument. However, by virtue of the existence of Section 93966-2M, misdemeanor battery has been made a lesser included offense of felony substantial battery. Now, let me point out here that normally the issue presented by this case would not arise because presumably, in most situations, the trial court would acquiesce in the joint request by both parties to give misdemeanor battery as a lesser included offense, since that is permitted by Section 93966. However, in the instant case, that didn't happen, and therefore the state did not have the benefit of jury consideration of both gradations of the offense. However, the judicial error should not lead to a bar against the state seeking justice through bringing the second offense when Section 939 prohibits a successive prosecution with respect to the designated included offenses only when a defendant has been convicted of the first charge.
Ms. McGee,
yes.
Let me, if I might, interrupt for a
minute. Surely.
When you were giving us your opening statement, you were indicating that in regard to the Kurosawa test, that only number 3 was at issue. And I want to talk a little bit, if I might, about number 2, about relitigating the factual issues. I've got, frankly, some concern in that regard. You've got the U.S. Supreme Court case of Ash versus Swenson, and that indicates that if the first jury has decided factual issues, that would have to be decided in the second case, that you can't retry. Now, you've got the same victim, you've got the same accused, you've got issues, I would think, in regard to striking or not striking the victim. How can you say that you're not in any way relitigating the same factual issues?
Well, first of all, with respect to that particular issue, whether or not there would be a relitigating of a fact that would be essential to the defendant having been acquitted on the first charge, the burden, according to the Seventh Circuit case of State v. Jacobs, is that the burden is on the defendant to come forward with an allegation of that nature, and that hasn't been done in this case. The defendant is required to show that the issue was actually decided in the first proceeding and that it must have been decided in order to acquit. In other words, substantial battery requires certain injuries that misdemeanor battery does not. The jury in the instant case could have decided and probably did decide that the injuries required to establish substantial battery were not proved. But this doesn't mean that they also decided that the injuries required to prove misdemeanor battery were not proved. The answer to that question was not one which was necessary to acquit on substantial battery charges. And returning to the case that you mentioned with respect to Ash versus Swenson, in that case, the issue was identity. And when the jury decided that the defendant was not one of the robbers who robbed the first victim because he wasn't there, they necessarily decided that he was not one of the robbers that robbed the second victim, because if he wasn't there for the first victim, he wasn't there for the second victim. But in the instant case, the defendant hasn't met the burden of coming forward with any allegation that a fact necessary to prove misdemeanor battery has been conclusively decided in his favor, and therefore I would have to say that that issue has not been brought appropriately.
Let me explore something with you. One of the points you raised or discussed in your opening remarks was the fact that here the state defense both requested the lesser included and the trial judge did not, and obviously the state can't appeal that, having the defendant having been acquitted of the felony battery. I'll tell you my concern is. My concern is that we not have subsequent trials for example, homicides. I mean, there's a whole range of homicides that this could apply to. Is the fact that the state requested the lesser included and the judge refused to give it a pivotal part of the argument? And how can we narrow this so that we're not having the state retrying defendants multiple times, for example, homicides, if the trial judge, for whatever reason, didn't give a lesser included or the trial, or nothing was requested? Or is there no way to limit what you're asking us to do?
Well, I would have to respond to that by saying that with respect to the homicide charges that are covered by 93966, as well as the other number of artificial, if you will, lesser included offenses, that our argument would indeed apply.
And does it matter whether or not they were requested at the first trial?
Whether or not it was
the lesser included, and we'll call it lesser included for this purposes. Whether someone requested it and it was refused, is that an element of being able to retry it or not? Does it make any difference?
I'm not sure. I would say that it certainly shows a public policy argument.
No, but my question is, if we are saying that this defendant can be retried or tried on the misdemeanor matter, is a part of that decision the fact that it was requested and not granted, or is it just the fact that there are different offenses and there's no double jeopardy problem, whether it was asked for by either side or not, it wasn't given, and therefore there can be a retrial? Which standard are you asking us to adopt? Simply, if there's an acquittal on one of the crimes and one of the other crimes is still available to the state, whether or not it was requested at the first trial, the state ought to be able to try the defendant on the second charge?
Well, I would have to say that the statutory interpretation that we seek at this point would result in that, because there's nothing that says anything about whether or not
the
jury...
The fact that it was requested here is irrelevant to the legal issue that you're asking us to address.
Insofar as the statute doesn't address that, I would have to say that with respect to all of these issues, that would be the case. I would like to address, in addition, though, your concern.
Yeah, because it is a valid concern that the state wants to get a defendant and tries the defendant on one charge, and there's an acquittal, then proceeds, and it runs a defendant through multiple prosecutions and trials until they either don't, they get a conviction or they don't, but you certainly can wear somebody down through that process.
Right, and I think that's been the concern in the differing interpretations of a situation involving successive prosecutions, with Grady being changed by Dixon and so forth over the last few years. However, I think that there are certain things that we can take into account. In this particular situation, of course, the jury wasn't permitted to consider the lesser charge, and the state didn't have the opportunity to prove its case as to the lesser charge.
We've just discussed that.
Right.
And they're not arguing that that makes a difference, right?
Right. In the absence of the statute, it would have been permissible, as it would be with respect to many criminal charges that are based on the same course of conduct that constitute different crimes. But even in a situation where you're talking about two crimes that have the same elements, there are situations where a retrial is allowed, such as a hung jury or a mistrial. And so I'm not sure if the question of fairness would preclude it in this instance when it doesn't in that instance. But as far as seriatim prosecutions are concerned, I think Justice Souter Justice Scalia addressed that in a footnote in Dixon when he pointed out that, and this is my own addition, apart from the ethics of doing something like trying to rehearse your evidence on a continuing basis until you get it right, that that is not something that the prosecutors actually have time to do. Secondly, they might run into the Ash problem with respect to not being able to relitigate certain issues or facts that come up. And eventually, I would assume that they would run into a problem of due process that would be quite apart from the double jeopardy issue. So I think, practically speaking, there are protections against that situation.
Practically speaking, why isn't it just easier to say that you don't do it twice if it's a crime listed under 60.66?
Do it twice?
Yeah. You've already had one shot at battery.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't prove your case.
Mm-hmm.
At least to that jury's satisfaction. Why don't you just say 66 applies and you don't get a second shot at the defendant if 66 lists that as a crime.
So your question, if I understand it, is that since the legislature has made them lesser included, then why don't we just treat it as we would any other lesser included offenses?
Sure. You can charge them with either the greater offense or the lesser offense. All the offenses. Here, the trial judge made a mistake. Not likely to happen very often in the state. So you can have an instruction on the lesser offense. I don't want to say lesser included, but lesser offense. So why are we here on this?
Well, I think there's... I hope I have set forth in my brief the various elements of our argument.
Now, I accept that. I mean, the court may not, but for the moment of oral argument, I accept that these elements are different. I accept that misdemeanor battery does not fit the Blockberger test. I accept that. Well, why can't you read 939.662M to say it doesn't apply to that it does apply to successive prosecutions? Why does the state care?
Well, first of all, as I mentioned earlier, the state did not have the opportunity to present its case.
I understand that because the trial judge made a mistake, but how often is that going to happen?
Well, as I indicated earlier, it's not likely to happen very often. But at this point, excuse me, I'm sorry.
So why should we then allow this?
Well, because according to the presentation that we've made with respect to statutory interpretation, the statute, to begin with, refers only to situations where convictions have taken place, and that refers more to multiple punishments, multiple convictions, those kinds of situations, and the legislature could have said convicted or acquitted, as it did in 93971, but it didn't. It just said convicted, and so our position would be that, as a matter of statutory interpretation, that it is permissible.
Let me ask you, is there any way with legal integrity to have this court hold that if the state has requested a lesser offense under 939.66 and the trial judges refuse to give it, they could retry them on that charge. But if the state makes the choice at the trial of one offense not to make that request, they can't lie in the weeds, lose the bigger offense, and then go around and recharge the defendant and have him retried on a lesser offense. Is there any way legally with integrity to have that kind of holding out of this court?
Well, I think I tried to respond to that question earlier. To the extent that the judge refused to give that instruction, as I said, the state never had the opportunity to present its
evidence. That's the factual situation here, but my question is, is in terms of a rule across the board.
Well, I don't think there's anything in the case law and the statutes at this point that would support an interpretation of the way the language reads right now. That's not.
What about if this, Justice Bail was just suggesting this as a possibility, what if we were to say that if the state doesn't raise the lesser offense in, under 93966, at the first trial, that there's a waiver of your ability to charge the lesser crime in a subsequent trial?
Well, waiver is a whole different issue than has been presented here, because the judge refused the request by both parties.
So your position is still that whether or not the state asked for it or not in the first trial, for, let's take a homicide situation, and the defendant's charged with first-degree intentional homicide, and there may be other homicides that have different elements that may be included under 93966. The state doesn't ask for them. The defense doesn't ask for them. The jury comes back not guilty. The state can turn around and charge another one, try the same thing, not guilty. And unless it's a due process violation, the state could charge the defendant a third time with a third type of homicide that may be a lesser homicide, and that there's no bar legally to them doing that other than a due process concern.
I'm not saying that there would never be a situation where a waiver could come into effect. I guess what I am saying is it didn't happen in this case.
Okay.
And
welcome.
Thank you.
I want to pursue what Justice Geske is saying here, because I'm struck that it just strikes me, I know this isn't great legal language, but it doesn't strike me quite as being fair. You know, for the defendant to have gone through a trial, and if the state sits back in the weeds, and I know it didn't happen here, the state sits back in the weeds and there's an acquittal, so then they come in with a little lesser charge, and then maybe even a little lesser charge. I think that's what Justice Geske was getting at. So what is wrong with a rule that says that if there is a lesser included offense that can be submitted, and the state does not submit it, does not make the request, that the state has waived then forever the opportunity to charge that defendant with a lesser included offense?
Well, I guess I couldn't comment on whether there's anything right or wrong with that, because in the context of this case, it didn't come up. I'm not saying that
he would prevail under that rule in this case.
True, absolutely. But nevertheless, it wasn't presented by this case. And as I say, certainly there may be many circumstances. Of course, the factual situations in all cases present different opportunities and possibilities for for interpreting them in different ways or finding waiver or whatever. And so I certainly wouldn't preclude that, but I'm just saying in this case it didn't happen. And so
I think what my colleagues would like you to do is hazard a guess on what you think would happen and what effect that would have if we're going to write this case, assuming that you would prevail, how that would be handled if the state did not avail themselves and just sat back in the weeds. So that's what they're asking. If the state simply didn't do anything about that. They did here. We understand their position.
Right. Well, in that situation, I guess it would depend on all the facts and circumstances surrounding that particular case and what happened in that particular case. And, you know, whether the state sat back in the weeds or facts didn't come to the knowledge of the state or whatever during the first prosecution, it would just have to be looked at in a situation where that might have been a possibility, I would say.
We have a problem about estoppel.
I'm sorry.
The problem potentially of a state being estopped and all the issues that go before that. You haven't briefed that whole issue, have you? Whether there's waiver, there could be waiver. You haven't briefed that issue.
Right.
And you don't want to stand here for the state and say what the state's position is, do you?
Not if it's on something that's apart from this case.
I get this feeling of discomfort. Hazardous to me.
At the trial court level, who is required to make the request for a lesser included offense to go to the jury?
Required?
Who makes the request?
Either party.
Can make it.
Sure.
Normally, it would be in the interest of the defendant, unless the state felt they had a weak case on the primary charge and then would ask for the lesser included offense. They're talking up here about a rule, and I'm just curious to know what effect that would have on trials. The state, but the defendant has an obligation to ask also. I've made my statement. There's no question.
Hey, I have a question.
Huh? I have a question. I guess I've always assumed the answer to this, but this case raises the problem in my head. If a defendant is acquitted on a lesser charge, can the state subsequently charge that defendant with higher crime involving the same act?
Well, that would depend on evaluating it under the same circumstances, I would think.
So the answer is possibly.
Right. I wouldn't say that it could never happen if you're indicating that up until this point you thought that it could never happen or it raises that question. It would have to be evaluated in terms of the same evaluation mechanisms that are set forth by the various.
Well, let's assume that the greater crime includes an element that the lesser crime did not. Like if for instance, he's charged with a battery and he's acquitted, and then later on, person dies or something like that. Can they be charged with a murder or a homicide?
Yes.
You would have to sort of do a Blackburger kind of analysis on it, though, for example.
In that particular factual circumstance.
Because if you did, for example, a robbery, and there was an acquittal, you couldn't turn around and charge armed robbery because they've been acquitted of those elements.
Exactly.
You'd also have to do an Ash versus Swenson evaluation, would you not?
Yes. Well, the remainder of my arguments are contained in my brief. Thank you very much.
And you get some moments,
Thanks, Nicky,
as you know. Mr. Kynes, you represent Mr. Vassos.
Thank you. Please, the court, good morning. I represent Procopius Vassos, a young man who was involved, as you know, in a fighting this.
He wasn't a driver who hit the last plane at one of Greece.
No. His parents might have come from there, but he wasn't involved in that, Justice.
To let everybody in on this, our prior case involved an American abroad who was hit in Greece by an uninsured person we assume is Greek, and that was the whole issue of whether there was insurance coverage.
A college student.
Right. But not of Lawrence.
But not from Lawrence.
All right. Okay, we now set the stage for you.
Sorry to interrupt you. Thank you. I think the facts as presented by the Attorney General's office are correct. The way the case got here is correct. The motion was a motion for double jeopardy before Judge Crean in Oshkosh. He granted that. Let me just say a few things here. First of all, I think the Blackburger test, we all agree, is a part of this entire argument here. That seems to me to be codified in both statutes which we've discussed, 939.71 and 939.66. I think those statutes are in harmony. If the court, when looks at those statutes, 939.66 appears under a heading, Rights of the Prosecution, and what I think that means is that those are rights given the prosecution and may be limited to the prosecution. In other words, what rights are limited. The Blackburger test under 939.71 is rights of the accused, and it's a limitation on the number of convictions. My argument, I guess, is to a large part quite simple, in that it would seem to me that the legislature, when they're talking about included crimes, listed under 939.66, the Blackburger test in Parens 1, they went on to list a whole series of included crimes. The homicide cases, which the court has talked about previously, the less serious or equally serious battery cases. And our contention is quite simple. If it is, in fact, a included crime, then having been found not guilty of the greater crime, we cannot be prosecuted for the underlying lesser crime. I think the court has pointed out that I think this is the way it works in our homicide statutes. In other words, if I, as a defense counsel, have a first-degree intentional homicide case, and I think that it's weak at that point, and I don't ask for a lesser included, and the district attorney thinks he's got a strong case, and the jury comes back and says not guilty, I don't think the district attorney has the right to then move forward on some lesser included. Or if I should come in and ask for lesser included on a self-defense theory or provocation theory, and the judge says to me, we don't have enough evidence on the record, Mr. Carnes, and I'm not going to give that instruction, and I'm not going to produce that as an optional verdict for the jury. Can then the district attorney's office go back to their office and charge it anyway? There's nothing to stop them from charging on a document. But can they charge it, and can we be then tried under a separate theory under which the judge has already told me that there's not enough facts to support the defense on it, second degree or self-defense theory? Can they go ahead and move forward on that? I think that the question here maybe is to battery and simple battery, but I think, as the justice has pointed out, I think there's a larger question here. Does this mean that we just kind of draw a large X through statute section number 39, 93966, and just use the Blackburger test, and that's what the legislature left us with? I don't think so. I think what they did was they limited the prosecution on a number of very specific issues here, one of them being this battery issue, another being the homicide issue, and there's obviously a series of other issues here. I think it's clear if we get found not guilty of a substantial battery, regardless of what the judge did on the request for a lesser included, the case is over insofar as the state is concerned.
So you think that the state had an opportunity and was able to try their full case, and that's your position because it's a greater and lesser, and it wasn't there, and then that's it. And then jeopardy takes place because of what happened in your trial.
Correct. I think jeopardy attaches, and the question of whether or not they had the opportunity to prove this element of non-consent. Once the legislature said it says included offense, and it's not presented to the jury, I don't think the district attorney's office can come back and charge it at a later date, which they did here.
Did the state cite the statute to the trial judge at the time of the argument of submitting the lesser included?
As I recall, no. I think it was an issue where the statute was not cited at all when the request was made.
And the judge sort of used a Blackburger kind of analysis to make a determination.
Correct. Exactly. That was the analysis he used. But that simply is, I guess, the defense's position. Unless there's some questions, I'm not going to kind of beat it to death.
Mr. Carnes, I'm interested in why you didn't raise the issue under Ash versus Swenson. In other words, why you're not claiming here that some of the facts that would have to be litigated in a second trial have already been litigated in the first trial.
Well, I think all the facts have been litigated except the question of whether the so-called victim gave consent to the battery. I don't know on what the jury decided. In other words, either there wasn't a substantial battery committed or my client did not intend to commit a substantial battery. They might have decided on the fact that there were some blows exchanged, but he never intended to commit a substantial battery. I have no way of knowing that because I didn't talk to the jury. But in terms of relitigating the facts, both know what the facts are, and I think that's exactly what happens in a case like this, is you relitigate the facts, because the easy one is the non-consent, obviously. I mean, that's really a non-issue, but has to be said in court.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Carnes. Ms. McGee, you're up sooner than you expected.
Yes, I am. With only a few comments in response, the defendant has noted that the legislature limited or indicates that he believes that the legislature limited prosecutions in 93966, but the clear language of the statute indicates that the limitation is on convictions. Insofar as your question with respect to whether or not the judge in the first case was directed to 93966, I don't think that it's part of the record. And I also wanted to point out that the Jacobs case that I cited earlier with respect to the Ash versus Swenson problem indicates that the fact had to be cited in order to acquit, in order for it to be a fact that cannot be relitigated. And, of course, in this situation, we're unsure exactly what happened, and that's one of the reasons that it's necessary for the burden to be on the defendant to bring forward an issue in that regard.
Counsel, I have a question. You say that in response to opposing counsel that the limitation is upon conviction or as to conviction and not prosecution. And
right.
Your opposing counsel is arguing that the limitation is on prosecution. I'm looking at 939-66-2M. Yes, 939-66. Why do you think the phrase upon prosecution for a crime is there? Is it superfluous in your interpretation?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat again where you're citing?
939-66. It's the introductory clause to the...
Upon prosecution for a crime, the actor may be convicted of either the crime charge. Well, it's just an introductory term, but the actual prohibition is contained in the conviction.
Is it surplusage? I mean, it has nothing... Based on your argument, it sounds like you don't need it.
Well, it would refer to all of the prosecutions, upon prosecution for a crime, the first time, the second time.
Okay.
Counsel, what if the substantial battery, the felony statute here, had the third element and the fourth element, i.e., the victim did not consent and the defendant knew that the victim did not consent? Okay, so let's assume that was the statute. I ask this question only because the anomaly of the lesser offense including an additional element is
the only difference between the two statutes is the substantial bodily harm in the first, the greater the felony, and just bodily harm.
Exactly. If the judge had refused to include the misdemeanor battery, would you be here today?
If the judge had refused to include
and consent was an element of the higher offense.
I'm sorry.
If the only difference was substantial battery versus battery.
Well,
you've got a Blackburger problem, right?
In other words, if they had, the elements of substantial bodily harm versus bodily harm?
No, let's rewrite the substantial. That's okay.
No, I didn't understand.
I didn't understand. Let's rewrite the substantial battery statute.
And it contains all of the same elements and doesn't pass the Blackburger test. In other words, it is a true lesser included offense.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah. And would we be here today?
No.
As a follow-up to that, why can't we infer in substantial battery that the common definition of battery is unwanted touching? So although it might not be explicitly stated, I mean, it's just inherent in the term battery that you have no consent and the defendant knew there was no consent. Why can't we just infer that and then say it meets the Blackburger test?
Meaning add extra elements that haven't been added by the legislature?
Well, battery means unwanted touching. Yeah, yes, the answer to your question. Battery means, let me hazard a guess. Battery means unwanted touching, so it's inherent in the definition.
No, well, it's not stated in the elements of the crime.
Do you think there's some danger in starting to infer elements to do a Blackburger analysis on that?
Justice Ginsburg.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The court will stand adjourned until its April sitting. The students would please remain here until they're joined, and Justice Getsky and I will come out at about noon. So you have a free 20 minutes.
When do we confer?
The court will come into conference at 1:30. 1:30.
Sure.
Thank you.